From NPR News, this is the podcast of the best of weekends on All Things Considered, the highlights from our shows this weekend. I'm David Greene, in for Guy Raz. We'll begin with a look at the humanitarian crisis in East Africa. There is violence and famine in the nation of Somalia, and hundreds of thousands of refugees are fleeing.
They either die by hunger or by bullet. And many of them said, heck with it, kill us, we have to go to Mogadishu.
Later, a new food magazine called Lucky Peach. The focus of their first issue, ramen. Also a frank and moving conversation with actor Will Wheaton, star of the film Stand By Me, which turns 25 this year.
I felt from the very first time we all got together that we were making something really special.
Our musical guest is the Los Angeles-based band Fool's Gold. And who's ruling the box office these days?
Cowboys, aliens, Smurfs, or apes?
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. We begin today in East Africa, where residents are suffering through the worst drought in 50 years. There are so many statistics that tell the story of this tragedy, none more than this one. 29,000 children have died in just the past 3 months. The epicenter is Somalia, where there are not only food shortages, but also political instability, violence, and a mass movement of frightened refugees. Each day, thousands more take a brutal journey on foot to refugee camps in Kenya, desperate for medical attention, food, and hope. Once they make it to the food line, it's chaos. Those sounds are from Dadaab, Kenya, home to nearly a half million displaced Somalis. It's the largest refugee camp in the world. And that's our cover story today, Somalia, a nation in tatters. In a moment, we'll talk to an aid worker at the refugee camp in Kenya, first to the political situation in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. The transitional government there has been battling an Islamist militant group known as Al-Shabaab, which controls the southern portion of the country. Abdirahman Yabro is a journalist, chief of the Somali service for Voice of America. He says Al-Shabaab had been acting like the solution, offering food and shelter, but Somalis were not quick to trust an armed group with links to Al-Qaeda.
People started not obeying Al-Shabaab because they figured out that in any way they'll die. They either die by hunger or by bullet. And many of them said, heck with it, kill us, we have to go to Mogadishu.
For families reaching Mogadishu, safety was no guarantee. Al-Shabaab also controlled much of the capital. They were blocking international aid groups from delivering food and medical supplies. But there seems to be a breakthrough this weekend. Al-Shabaab retreated from the capital. Their leaders said this is just a tactical move, but Abdirahman Yabro says this could be a sign the militant group is getting weaker.
Al-Shabaab had leaders from Somalia or Somalis, indigenous, and Somali and foreigners. So those two leader groups were in conflict for quite some time.
With the unrest in Mogadishu, many Somalis' best chance to get much-needed food has been to journey to those refugee camps in Kenya. Stephanie Savario of the UN World Food Program says the flow of Somalis into the Dadaab refugee camp shows no sign of slowing down.
What we're seeing is still a large influx of people arriving every day here from Somalia. The influx is actually not slowing down, it's increasing. We have about 1,500 people arriving daily. They've walked for days, they're very tired, especially children arrive in a very, very bad shape. I mean, I've met someone this morning, a family who came with a child whose parents had died on the way. And so the child basically is now part of this new family and is also receiving assistance. But the stories you hear are really, really sad.
And Stephanie, how many refugees are there in the camps in Dadaab?
Well, we're talking about, you know, more than 420,000 people at the moment.
420,000?
Yes, that's the figure that of people that the World Food Program is feeding. On top of that, there are a lot of services, especially for children, malnourished children, but also pregnant and lactating women who can get added assistance in hospitals or health posts. It's extremely difficult to look at children. So today I saw a family The woman had six children. You know, her husband stayed behind in Somalia because he was still actually hoping that things would get better. And he had a family member who was sick, so he wanted to stay behind. But their child was 2 years old, and she really, really looked like a 10-month-old baby. And she was coughing, and she had very, very tiny legs. I was telling the woman, maybe you need to bring her to hospital. And she said, but I've been there already, and I'm so tired. And, you know, if I need to get back, the hospital is so far, and I've got the other children to take care of. I mean, it's a desperate situation.
Can you tell us what the biggest challenges, issues facing the relief effort are as of now?
Well, yes. I mean, the challenges are resources and logistics, in a way, and time. We need... we don't have time. Basically, we need continuous funding because the numbers keep growing. And because of this very high malnutrition rates, we need more specialized food for children, especially children under five. As more refugees come, it means to build more shelters, more latrines. And we need to do that now. And that takes a bit of time. It can't be done in one day. So we don't have that time. The time is running out, and that's the biggest difficulty. We need to do things now because people are just here and they have nothing.
It's the voice of Stephanie Savario from the UN World Food Programme, and she joined us from Dadaab, Kenya. Thank you so much for talking to us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
One of the unforgettable images from this crisis in Somalia was a photograph that was splashed across the front page of the New York Times this past week. What you saw is a small boy, almost skeletal, lying curled up on his side in a filthy hospital. His hands were reaching back to his head in unimaginable pain. That picture alone may have done more for awareness of the situation than any plea for help could have. Veteran photojournalist Tyler Hicks took the photograph. He's back home in Turkey now, but still thinking about the scene outside the frame of that picture.
It's really quite a hellish place. The hospital is completely filled with people. The most affected were the children. It's an open-air environment. There's kind of a few windows that are open. And as you walk in, you can just hear children crying. There's room after room filled with people. And also spilling out into the hallway where even a single cot would have two or three children on it. And any space, any open space where you could put a person, there would be a child there. And it wasn't just that they were skinny. It was that they were so sick. You know, the children were vomiting, their eyes rolling back in their heads. Some of them, like this boy, you couldn't even really tell he was alive until you saw him move, just skin and bones.
Tyler Hicks, it seems like whenever there's a war, your name is showing up on the photos in the Times. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. I mean, you've shot some of the most harrowing situations of this young century in many ways. How does what you saw in Somalia compare?
I'd say that the condition of the people is one of the worst that I've seen. I've worked in Haiti, Afghanistan, Iraq. Also in the wake of natural disasters, so tsunami. And this was the first time I really saw such numbers of people who were clearly starving to death. And the difference was that once they reach Mogadishu, there's no help for them. There's no resource. It's not like they're suddenly, okay, we made it and we're going to be okay now. There's nothing there for them. There's so few resources in Mogadishu, even at the hospital. Some of the photographs you can see, there are children just with flies all over their faces. And this is a big problem. They didn't even have mosquito nets. Families don't have money to buy a mosquito net that only costs a few dollars.
Tyler, what emotions are you going through as a photographer in a moment like this? I guess you know that your work can help people in some abstract way, but you can't reach out and help this child right there as you're just standing there.
Yeah, it's never easy, and my job there is to take photographs that are going to get recognized that people are going to react to. So really, while I'm there, I really have to focus on that work and focus on capturing the situation that's going on there. later, when I look at the pictures, when I'm back in my hotel room or looking on my laptop and sending these in, I actually react more to those scenes than when I'm actually shooting them. It, of course, this affects me. I think about these people all the time, and I think that if you didn't, that there'd be something wrong with you, or you shouldn't be the one to do this type of work. You have to really want to be there in order to tell their story.
Your name was in the news back in March as part of a New York Times team that was held captive in Libya, and here you are back in another dangerous part of the world at work again. What compelled you to get back so quickly?
It's really people process things like that differently. We were held for a week, and at least for part of that was pretty brutal. We came out of it at the other end, and for me that's really, you know, I'm able to walk away from that with a bad memory. And that doesn't mean that it's time to stop following what I believe in.
Salon.com ran an article about your work, and they asked the question, can a photograph still change the world? What's the answer?
I don't know about change the world. I think it can change policy. I think a photograph can change the way people think. You know, I've seen this happen over the years. You know, it's not that often in one's own career that you have these kind of photographs that really make that impact. But I do think that the power of photography, of the single image, even in today's digital age where so many things are moving pictures and video and with all the multimedia, you can still see that, you know, the reaction that a single still image can have. And that's because it has a way of searing itself into your mind. It's something that you can study. I think that is the best way to communicate.
We've been speaking to Tyler Hicks. He's a photojournalist with the New York Times. Tyler, be safe, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Next time you swing by the magazine stand, you might come across something called Lucky Peach. It's a food magazine, but don't expect 20 simple dinners you can make in 20 minutes. Instead, there's poetry, fiction, and also chefs swearing at each other. The first issue is focused on ramen. Not those little packages we all made back in our college dorm rooms, but ramen as a delicacy with a rich and complicated history. Lucky Peach editor Peter Meehan created the magazine with New York noodle baron David Chang. Meehan says he once wrote a ramen recipe that was 30 pages long.
You spend 2 pages explaining what alkaline noodles are and what alkalinity in food is, and that's just the noodles, and then you talk about the broth, and, you know, it's a dashi, and then it's a pork stock on top of that, and it's not just seasoned with soy sauce, but usually it's a soy sauce that's been cooked with other things called atare. So that 30 pages was trying to explain all of these components that go into making a bowl of ramen.
Don't worry, you're not going to find a 30-page ramen recipe in Lucky Peach, but you will find a sense of how important the soup is in Japanese culture.
There are people who spend every weekend, you know, going and finding new bowls, experiencing new ramen that is there around Japan. So if you go to Japan, there are literally 4 or 5 ramen magazines on the shelves at grocery stores, and they're filled with hundreds and hundreds of reviews of ramen shops and what goes into the broth and what this guy does. So
kind of overwhelming.
It's a big subculture there.
And I'm paging through the book now and the magazine, and the beginning of Lucky Peach is really a sort of a travel log of you and David Chang hanging out in Japan, searching for great ramen. And I was stunned because you ate this unbelievable amount of noodles, and you write that you guys, I mean, were almost sick.
No. We were very actually sick. We were there for, you know, we were in Tokyo for 6 or 7 days, and we ate as many bowls of ramen as we physically could. But it's rude to leave noodles in your bowl. So you go there and you crush these gigantic bowls of noodles, and, you know, it's in a very rich pork fatty broth. So there were only so many bowls we could get in 5 or 6 days with the other meals that we had planned to go to. But we tried to pack them all in.
And you said you spent a lot of nights drunk dreaming of noodles as you were going to bed in the hotel room.
That is a byproduct of eating noodles all day and then drinking all night.
So this is not a food magazine. This is like 170 pages of interesting tales of your travels. There are recipes. You swear a lot. I mean, what are you really going for? Is this a new kind of cookbook? Is it an experience?
You know, I mean, I think it's one of those things where you're sitting in a room and you're like, let's make a new food magazine. And that's a terrible idea. The world does not need a new food magazine. But
right.
If it's such a bad idea that you can do a good version of it, then that's a cool challenge.
This seems like sort of a strange time to jump into a new food magazine. I mean, a magazine like Gourmet gets shut down a couple of years ago. I mean, do you have a death wish? What makes you think this is going to really succeed?
I think it mainly is death wish. and it's disappointing to us that it's ended up being as popular as it's been. I mean, it's a small scale popularity, but we've done two pressings and it looks like we're going to go to a third.
The recipes in this book, these are not recipes from Grandma's Cookbook. And you actually have one recipe in haiku. I'm looking at page 121. It's corn with miso, butter, and bacon, a recipe in haikus. Can you read that for me?
Oh, man. This is a dramatic reading of a recipe. This is a low point for me, I think. Hold on. Render the bacon, add the corn. Jump and sizzle as gold turns to brown. Miso and butter joined in equal proportions plop into the pan. Splash stock, then toss. Glaze. Crack slow poached egg to crown like Hokkaido sunset.
That was beautiful. A little more emotion in the plop, but that was really that was very nice. I'm ready to cook it, and we're gonna try and taste some ramen because you really have us in the mood. If we find a noodle shop out here in Southern California, what should we be looking for? I mean, if we walk in the door, what will make us say this is a really great place?
When you eat ramen, you sit there, you bend yourself over the bowl when it's piping hot, right when it's been handed to you. And you're going to slurp those noodles. You're not chewing them. You're not cutting them up. You're trying to inhale them like a human noodle vacuum. And they should slurp in a pleasing way. And then that broth that they're served in, should dress the noodles. It should coat the noodles. It should flavor the noodles. And I think it seems like the simplest thing in the world for a bowl of noodle soup to do. But when you're in front of a bowl and that's happening, that's, you're most of the way there.
We've been talking to Peter Meehan. He's the co-editor of Lucky Peach magazine, and he's quite a connoisseur of ramen noodles. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thanks so much for having me.
And after talking for that long about ramen, I mean, how could we go without tasting some? And so we came to this Japanese market in L.A., and at the back there's a window and a kitchen. They are making and serving a lot of ramen. That was all I needed to hear. We talked our way back into that kitchen.
Could we ask you a question or two about ramen?
19-year-old Andrew Solo is one of the cooks.
What makes good ramen to you? Like, what's the
best? The soup makes it really good.
As for what's involved in making that soup, pork feet, pork ribs, fish bones, and they cook it all for 17 hours.
17 hours.
Yeah, and then we have to taste it before we take it.
As for Peter Meehan's 30-page ramen recipe?
30 pages?
30 pages.
Well, actually, the step is a lot, but I'm not surprised because it is hard to make ramen.
Of course, I wasn't leaving.
Salt ramen?
Just one salt?
One salt.
Without a taste.
It's really hot.
I'm sweating a little bit. Think it was worth the heat? You bet it was. I had to ask the manager.
What makes it milky? Is salt ramen always like a milkier?
It's my secret.
It's your secret.
Okay. It's really good.
Is it good?
It's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, we're
good. So there's a taste of ramen from Santuca Ramen on South Centinela Avenue here in LA.
Bob Cormier here. It's a beautiful Friday morning in Portland. It's 90 KLAM degrees and getting hotter.
We're going to take you back in time now to a hot summer in Oregon.
It's Boss!
The film Stand By Me told the story of four young boys.
Gun will travel, reads the card of a man. A knife without armor in a savage land.
They were 12 years old, their entire lives in front of them. Richard Dreyfuss narrated the movie as the voice of one of the boys, all grown up and remembering how important their childhood adventure was.
Everything was there and around us. We knew exactly who we were and exactly where we were going.
The four youngsters hiked into the wilderness searching for the dead body of another kid. What they saw, what they talked about, what they discovered about themselves all became the quintessential coming-of-age story, and it still is even today, 25 years later. The child actor at the center of that movie, the kid version of Richard Dreyfuss's character, was Will Wheaton, and he's with us in the studios of NPR West. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
You know, it's kind of amazing. Stand By Me, the film, debuted 25 years ago Monday, and you were 12 years old.
Yeah, I actually turned 13 during production.
Wow. Well, you made a few other films before that, but this was the first time you were really in a lead, right? Was it scary?
No, I was too young to know that I should be afraid. I felt from the very first time we all got together up in Oregon that we were making something really special. And I don't know how much of that is just the naivete of being 12 and being an actor and being excited to be on location working on a feature, and how much of that was actually what we really felt when we were all together working on the film.
You start alongside River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, Corey Feldman. And to me, what makes the movie so great and memorable is really the chemistry that the four of you really shared on screen. Where did that come from? I mean, was that a product of the relationships you had on the set?
I think that the casting in Stand By Me is one of the reasons the movie is such an incredible success. Rob Reiner found four young boys who basically were the characters we played. I was awkward and nerdy and shy and uncomfortable in my own skin and really, really sensitive. And River was cool and really smart and passionate and kind of, even at that age, kind of like a father figure to some of us. Jerry was one of the funniest people I had ever seen in my life before or since.
He's Vern, the bigger kid.
Right. And Corey was unbelievably angry and in an incredible amount of pain and had an absolutely terrible relationship with his parents.
The role of a father, and you said you have two kids of your own, really came into focus in the movie. Gordy, your character, had lost his brother, who was a football star, and Gordy was dealing with this fear that his dad wished it had been him who died.
Yeah, it's really clear Gordy's parents loved Denny, his older brother, and just didn't bother to really make a connection with Gordy.
Let's listen to a little of you talking about this from the movie.
Why do you have to die, Chris? Why did Denny have to die? Why? I don't know. It should have been me. Don't say that.
My dad said it. I'm no good.
He doesn't know you.
He hates me.
No. He just doesn't know you.
He hates me. My dad hates
me. Do you ever think about that as a dad now, dealing with your own kids?
I'm crazy about my kids. My older son is home from college this summer, and we've spent the summer doing things together, and we're making our own beer together, and we went to Comic-Con together, and I have this incredible closeness to him. My younger son, you know, he's turning 20, and he's sort of like off kind of figuring himself out, and I don't have the same closeness with him that I have with his brother, just because he's kind of at a different place in his life. And I would never want to make my kids feel like I thought they were no good or that I, you know, loved one more than another or anything like that. But there's so much pain in that scene. And as a parent, I work to maintain relationships with my kids and respect kind of where they are in their lives and just be a good dad. And Rob told me that he wrote that scene, and it had a lot to do with his relationship with his own father, and that Gordy and Chris were sort of having this proxy discussion that Rob kind of needed to have. And he described sitting down in the hotel room in Oregon to write that scene and just sitting at his typewriter and sobbing as he wrote it.
I'm speaking with writer and actor Will Wheaton. He starred in the film Stand By Me, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. I just want to play one more scene from the film. This is when you and Chris Chambers are talking about your plans for school. And you're a smart kid. You're going to be going into the college courses.
Right, into woodshop.
He's going into woodshop, and you're trying to tell him that he should come with you.
Maybe you could go into the college courses with me. He won't let me.
I'm just one of those low-life Chambers kids.
And we should say that's actor River Phoenix, who played your best friend in the
who
movie,
Chris
right. Chambers. He died in 1993 of an overdose. You know, such a promising young actor at the time, and Stand By Me really launched his career. Talk about your relationship with him.
We were extremely close during production. I loved him. He was smart, and he was musically talented, and he was kind. He was one of the kindest people I'd ever been around. And as we stayed friends after we worked on the film, and I went and visited his family, and I guess around the time that I was turning maybe 15, we just drifted apart, and I always felt really sad about that. And when I saw Corey at the studio when we recorded the commentary for the Blu-ray, we talked about that, and he said, I went to see him over and over and over, because Corey had gotten sober, and he said, I went to see him over and over and over right before he died, and nobody could reach him. And then in the film, River Phoenix's character Chris dies. And there's this scene at the end of the movie where he fades away as Gordy's waving goodbye to him. And we sit there, you know, the three of us, Rob Reiner, Corey Feldman, and I are sitting there watching it. And
this was just recently. You were
just recently, yeah. And it was like all the air went out of the room. And we couldn't talk. And it's still something that fills me with a lot of conflicting emotions.
What should we take from all that? If we're trying to learn lessons from this movie and sort of its coming-of-age quality, and it does seem like there's this very eerie parallel between Chris Chambers, the character, and River Phoenix, the actor. I mean, how do you sort of deal with all this?
Stand By Me, it sort of talks about this time in your life that's feels incredibly complicated, but as you get older, you realize is actually incredibly simple. And we get the tremendous gift of not knowing that it's never going to be like that again for the rest of our lives. So it's just, it's pure and it's uncomplicated. And it's a time that stays with us even as we become adults. And I remember when my kids were the age that I was in Stand By Me. And I just thought, enjoy it, you guys.
You know, well, it's interesting. When we started talking about doing something around this anniversary, I thought we'd be talking about kind of an old movie that was in your past. But it really does seem to inspire, you know, emotion for you and a lot of people still today.
I'm really lucky. A lot of actors will spend their entire careers trying to find a film like Stand By Me. And I got to have it when I was a kid. And I get to stand on top of that for the rest of my life.
That's actor and writer Will Wheaton, an alum of Star Trek The Next Generation, and of course also of the film Stand By Me, which hit theaters 25 years ago on Monday. Will, thanks so much for being here with us.
It's my pleasure.
When the night has come and the land is dark.
For our music feature this week, a band that brought together this perfect mix of African melodies and Hebrew lyrics. Take a listen to Fool's Gold. That's a track from their debut album a couple years ago. The critics said beguiling, they said joyous, and that unique marriage of influences won over legions of fans. But for the latest Fool's Gold record, Leave No Trace, they've practically left no trace of Hebrew. The lyrics are mostly in English. The two founding members of the band Fool's Gold are guitarist Louis Pezikoff and vocalist Luke Topp, and they join me in the studio out here at NPR West. Welcome to you both.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having us.
So, Luke, what happened to the Hebrew? You made it work really well on that first album.
Well, thanks so much. you know, I think this record was a process of evolution and articulation, really. And I think singing English was just seemed like the natural next step in our evolution. I kind of learned how to sing by singing in Hebrew and kind of wanted to take what I learned and apply it to my native tongue.
You were born in Israel, but you actually had to relearn Hebrew, take some language and get it back.
Yeah, I had a really bare-bones conversational level of Hebrew that we spoke in my household. So to write lyrics, as it were, I needed some assistance for sure.
Well, before we get to all the new English on this new album, there is one song on the new album that does revive that marriage of Hebrew and English lyrics. It's called Tel Aviv, and let's hear a bit of that. So the lyrics here suggest a longing for Israel. You sing, I take a bow and lock my knees and think of you, my Tel Aviv.
Yes. Well, you know, the song, you know, even though it specifies Tel Aviv, it's really just a longing for a sense of home, you know. I moved to Los Angeles, Southern California as a small child, but I never quite felt tethered to one place or another. I kind of felt like in this strange purgatory of what is home, what does it mean to be growing up in this country, what does it mean to have a home that's, you know, so rich with history and obviously a conflict. So the song Tel Aviv is somewhat autobiographical, but also just kind of deals with this idea of what is home exactly.
Tell me about how the band came together. I mean, as you were putting together the first album, it sounded like jam sessions. You would welcome anybody. I mean, I could have come in and said, I can pick up an instrument. I mean, you had like 12 people, 15 people.
Definitely. It was open door. When we first started, Luke and I bonded over the idea of kind of opening up what it was. We'd been playing music together for a long time, but playing, like, you know, short pop songs, 3-4 minute songs, and we really were interested in allowing songs to breathe and maybe just to jam on one note and kind of find a trance for like 20 minutes. And also to allow anybody we know to come play with us, and because I think that there are a lot of other musicians in the Los Angeles community who are kind of looking for this musical outlet that was a little freer. A lot of people would show up and play with us. I mean, you never knew who was going to come. There's always percussion. There was times we had 4 guitar players, 2 keyboard players, you know, and it felt really great.
Luke, it sounds like this album has made you guys a little more orderly. You've had to cut down the number of people, keep things a little more organized, shut the door, so to speak.
Well, yeah, it is, as you can imagine, you know, we toured on that first album for about 2 years, and with that comes many logistical situations where it's from one tour to the next, we didn't necessarily know who was in the band.
That can be challenging.
So I think after a couple of years of that, we were just kind of left with this 5-piece, and we decided that this was the core unit.
Has it been hard to say no to people who want to come in and join the band? I mean, if you're limiting things to like 5 people now, do you have old friends who kind of call and say, hey, I'm still around. I'm still, I'm interested in playing.
Constantly.
You guys want me back?
Especially the good gigs. People always want to jump in on the good gigs.
Of course. You guys are touring with Red Hot Chili Peppers in the fall. I bet a lot of people are like, hey, yeah, still right here. We're happy to go on tour with you. My guests are Louis Pezikoff and Luke Topp from the band Fool's Gold, and their new album is called Leave No Trace. And another track from the new album is called Balmy. Guys are both swinging your heads around. This feels very trance-like to me. And I've been reading about some of the music coming out of Mali. They call it desert blues, which I guess is pretty trance-like. Are you drawing a bit from that tradition here?
Definitely. I think we're definitely drawing from music from Mali. But this track, maybe it's a little bit more of the Mandé tradition, which is kind of the classical music of the Mali kingdom.
Luke, you were born in Israel, and both of you guys are Jewish. A lot of the musical styles that you explore have Muslim roots, and I guess I'm wondering, do you think about that? Does that cross your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially when we're able to collaborate with artists that are also from different religious backgrounds. For example, we did this kind of incredible collaboration with the band Tenari Wen, and, you know, there was never any real discussion of where we were from, what we're all about, what we believe in. It kind of, we just came together in this really organic, musical way.
One of the nagging criticisms of bands like yours is that it's white musicians who are sort of using music from impoverished, mostly black parts of the world and, you know, making money, going on tour. Right. Is that something you've dealt with? And what do you,
sure,
what
I
does
mean,
that make
I,
you think about?
You know, people say this quite a bit, but I think that if you stop looking at it like we're colonialists, we're just sharing music. And when we actually have these experiences and play with African musicians, they are so happy that we're playing African music. They're blown away that we're interested in their culture. They're blown away that we can play the music, and they're so excited that we're sharing it with other parts of the world where maybe they wouldn't have access to.
Louis Pesikoff, the guitarist and one of the founding members of the band Fool's Gold, along with vocalist Luke Topp. Their new album is called Leave No Trace. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in. It's been fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Well, you know, it's also hard to spend a week in Los Angeles without movies on our minds. And at the box office, this month so far has been one weird creature flick after another, battling for that top spot. Cowboys and Aliens?
Grab your guns. We're right now.
Well, they tied the Smurfs last weekend.
La, 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 sing a happy song.
Stop!
But this weekend's Rise of the Planet of the Apes smashed them both.
They are contaminated.
All this made us want to send producer Brent Bachman out to L.A.'s luxurious Arclight Hollywood Theater.
Test.
To ask one simple question.
Cowboys, aliens, Smurfs, or apes?
Cowboys and Indians, what? Which one?
Cowboys, aliens, Smurfs, or apes?
Smurfs. Apes. We just saw it and it's the best movie ever.
Yeah, what's the deal with cowboys and aliens?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
Are you going to see Apes right now?
No.
What are you going to see?
Midnight in Paris.
So, Cowboys, Aliens, Smurfs, or Apes? Woody Allen.
Yes.
He would win in a fight.
Well, no.
I think I'm going to get better as I get older.
Apes. They're underdogs. The apes are
aliens
underdogs.
Couldn't even defeat the Cowboys. That's why.
And the Cowboys don't even have electricity, right?
Donnie Darko talks about, in the movie, he talks about how Smurfs don't have reproductive organs. And what's the point of living if you don't have a...
There's no call for that kind of language, laddie.
Before I ask you the question, will you tell me what you're wearing?
I'm wearing a cowboy outfit.
And you're wearing?
A cowgirl outfit. It's a friend's birthday, and happy birthday.
Can I ask you guys this question? Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Cowboys, aliens, Smurfs, or apes?
I mean, all things considered, the X-Men could beat them all. Like, there's a blue one, so you cover your Smurfs.
Check.
There's an alien.
Check.
And there's probably a cowboy.
No answers, only questions from producer Brent Bachman. And that's the podcast edition of the Best of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Kenya Young, Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Kevin Lasky. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. And this is a sad day. It's Matt's last show. Let me hand off for a moment to your regular host, Guy Ross.
Every once in a while, when there's room at the end of the program, we read credits, the names of the folks who help create 2 hours of original radio each weekend. They don't always get the full recognition they deserve, but each week they are with me and with you. Just 9 people put this show together. For all of us, it's a labor of love. We are a tight-knit group, and when one of us goes, it's always a sad occasion. And today, we are sad to say goodbye to Matt Martinez. He now heads to the weekdays, where he'll produce All Things Considered. Matt came to this program 2 years ago, and in that time, he's left his mark. So, Matt, good luck. We'll miss you. And don't be a stranger.
You can hear Guy and this program on your local public radio station in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. That's the podcast for this week. I'm David Green. We'll be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. As always, thanks for listening.